said Angelica. A sorry state when a woman of means may not spoil a dress or two. Turning to the gentleman, she cries, "Which of you is man enough to volunteer his arms to a siren?" Which of them, of course, but Mr. Rockingham, who was at her elbow before she has finished speaking, with a great linen towel and a twitch to his handsome eyebrow. He grips her forearm and lets her lean her wet hands against him as she scrambles onto dry land. "Oof!" she gasps as the goose flesh erupts across her arms. But although he holds up the towel like a barricade to the company, he does not cover her up straight away. Her chemise is transparent and plastered to her body, with bubbles of air where it stretches between her breasts and the hollow between ribcage and belly. His eyes flutter across her without a word, and she feels no shame nor disappointment, only that this is the greatest caper she ever took a part in. A smile bursts across her face without her bidding it there, and she feels the tips of her ears grow hot. His smile mirrors hers, although he puts his chin down to hide it. And for a moment they stand together while webs of mirth and desire and joy stretch between them. Then he wraps her up and tussles the coarse linen over her shoulders and back. "Come," he says. "I shall find you a cup of negus to warm you up. But then you have nothing to wear."
"Not a stitch," agrees Angelica.
There are currently 10 young ladies resident in Mrs. Chapel's home, and a great wardrobe room laid on for them to choose from upwards of 3 times a day. This is, therefore, a barefaced lie.
"There is nothing for it. We shall have to take you to bed."
"What a shame,"
she whispers, the water pooling about her feet.
"I've been so enjoying myself."
Chapter 17. The wool curtains are pulled flush around his bed, and if the dawn is approaching, and the great conversation of the birds suggests so, not one ray of it reaches him. He lies in his shirt, his breeches discarded and his cuffs flung into a corner, and keeps his eyes fast closed. Perhaps he is inclined to throw back his covers and pace the room, or take up a candle and a book. He might remove himself to his counting house if he chose, or walk the dawning streets. He might, but he does not dare. This is the hour for sleep, and so he dutifully adopts its attitudes. And still he cannot help thinking, "I have made a terrible mistake. To put my greatest asset into such a den of iniquity, to associate my name with that level of barbarism." He groans aloud. His eyes are closed, and at the corners of his vision, clouds of colour roll. "But what am I to do? If I wish my mermaid to succeed, I must learn to conduct myself in these circles. I've such losses to recoup," he announces to his woolen chamber, and he lies thinking on that dreadful thought until the bells of St. Nicholas's sound on one side of him, and those of St. Paul's sound to the other, and he knows it is time at last to rise. "And yet, why must my mermaid succeed at all? Can I not put it away like so much old lumber, and forget this sorry episode?" He raps on Suki's door as he passes it.
"Up! Get up!"
he calls. But he cares little whether she does or no.
"Because of the money, of course. Because my sister is disgusted with me, and my niece depends on me. I have nothing else of note in my life, and now that I'm saddled with this freak, I must profit by it."
And indeed he has profited, for one of England's most skilled priestesses of love, one of the very finest models of womanhood, was last night willing to take him to her bed. As if a man of his sort, a merchant, a son of Deptford, might have the opportunity to touch her. And like a fool, he was appalled.
"I rejected her, humiliated her.
Is not that a judgment upon my own self rather than upon her? Is it merely that I lack the sophistication that comes naturally to another quality of man? Bridget is up, he knows, by the cold air that nips past him as he comes down the stairs, for as usual she has left the yard door open while she goes to the pump. He has had words with her about this before, but she will not change.
"Takes too long,"
she replies, looking at her toes, and he thinks, a woman of the house would know how to make her obedient. She has not yet opened the shutters, and only a little daybreak slips through them. Mr. Hancock has to lift his bunch of keys to within an inch of his nose to make it out at all, and as he peers and paws at it, a piece of the darkness unfurls from the skirting and wraps itself, velvet soft and purposeful, around his calves. "God's teeth!" he exclaims, picking up his feet like a stout old maid jumping rope. He wrenches open the front door. Light floods in, and the cat scampers out.
"What are you at?"
Mr. Hancock fumes, but he follows her onto the street and grinds the lock fast behind him. Overnight, Deptford's heady miasma had begun to settle like silt in a puddle, but sunrise stirs it back up again, and Mr. Hancock stumps through that great rich stink of baking bread and rotten mud and old blood and fresh sawn wood, with the cat trotting on her tiptoes beside him.
"What sort of a world can this be," he is fuming to himself, "in which a whore stoops to an honest man?"
The end of the mortal world is heralded by signs of such disorder. A man yoked to the plough, a fox pursued by a hare. He has seen it etched on gravestones, too, a heart turned upside down. He will not suffer a ferryman today, nor crush himself into the public coach that will bear him joltingly into the heart of the city. Nor does he desire to take the path along the stinking river, where every shipbuilder in every yard and every waterman at every step knows his name and his business. He chooses instead to walk the long way, spurning Southwark's crush and reek for a stride across open fields, and thus turns up Butt Lane, where the boys from the bakery run giddy on the flagstones, their shirts untucked and flapping. There is a heap of oranges outside one of the little shingle-clad shacks, all puckered and foxed, the saddest oranges in Christendom, their innards, no doubt, fibrous dry. They are by no means fit for sale, but this makes no odds, since they will never be sold. They are moral decoys, merely, for above them swings the sign of the Jolly Mariners, and within, the last raddled drab may yet be rinsing her shift before falling into her bed alone at last. Mr. Hancock's lips twitch at the thought. He would like to spit on the threshold. On the parcel of land next door, the shipwrights are at work, singing together as they haul up beams. "The world turned upside down indeed," he thinks, "beginning with my own town." For here the shipwrights take their work upon dry land, and amongst them there is not the usual hierarchy of kings and lords, but only that of skill. No class, but what is ordained by one's work group. Here labourers prize their fine china and shelves of books. Here wives are husbandless 2 sea-going years in 3. Here shipmasts tower over church steeples. Here he is, sorry Jonah Hancock, a husband without a wife, a father without a son, paterfamilias of a she-house ruled by little maids, and whose years of faithful work have accrued no fortune to compare to what a freak goblin can bring him. It is half a mile up to the New Cross Turnpike, the road already moderate busy. A small boy bobs out of the whitewashed tollbooth to heave open the gate at the swift approach of the Dover stagecoach. Behind it creeps a wagon laden with sacks and rope-lashed boxes, on top of which ride pale-faced newcomers to the city, an old man with only a flour sack tied about his pitiful body, mumbling his toothless gums, a mother who draws her infant close beneath her shawl. Two pretty country girls turning out their bundles in search of coins to pay their final stage. They look about themselves in bewilderment.
Be we in London now?
And pinch the blood into their cheeks and straighten their kerchiefs.
For the fine ladies, don't want mazes, don't look healthy. Don't look decent,
one says to the other as the wagon lurches onward. To the west, towards the city, the fields are picked brown and bare, and the trees stand open-armed and stripped of fruit. Even the blackberries in the hedgerows are gone now, the coils of brambles that bore them sagging into wayside ditches full of grey water. Far away to the south, the masts of ships are fewer on the river, and stand in tall huddles with their sails drawn close about them. As he strides onward, another thought strikes him. Confound the rest of the situation. It is a fact that last night a pretty young woman, remarkable pretty, alive with her very prettiness, put her hand on his and gazed into his eyes. She kissed him on the lips, this buxom, lovely girl. He might, at this moment, be basking in her embrace, her bedclothes tangled around them and her soft arm flung across his chest. She might lean above him, so her golden hair streamed down around them, and the sunlight took fire in its strands. He had, in fact, the opportunity to lie skin upon skin and limb upon limb with another living body, to be the focus of another's touch and thought. This is what he turned down last night. Not a whore, and not a prize, but a moment of contact between man and woman. "Damn you!" he spits, kicking the dirt of the road and alarming the old spinster sisters who have just toddled up from their cottage in the beet field.
"Excuse me, ladies," he says. "I have a great fear of ants, a great and an unreasonable fear."
It is in this very fog of confusion and rage that he strides the leafy Kent road, where other men of his sort descend the steps of handsome brick houses to their waiting carriages. This new breed of man keeps his home in the countryside, in preference to squashing his family into the apartments above his office. His children learn to paint and are sent away to school, and yet even after plucking up the courage to append an audacious Esquire to his name, none of these men would stand for such behaviour as Mr. Hancock witnessed last night.
"For shame," he thinks. "We live on a different scale of morality. And which is the correct one?"
He regrets his solid provincial decency. He is sorry that the memory of the priapic sailors brings such a wave of horror to his soul, for those people are so much happier than he is. Furthermore, he reflects as he comes upon Borough and the fields melt away to tide alleys and sunless yards, and the city begins to loom and to crowd, and thence with aching calves across London Bridge and into the mercantile crush of Lombard Street. Furthermore, by whatever moral compass one chooses, his treatment of Angelica Neal, rebuffing her generosity at a function organised in his own honour, is reproachable.
"I shall seek an audience with her," he tells himself. "Apologise for my behaviour. She may be understanding of my confusion."
Yes, this seems to him a good plan. He tries not to think too hard about the other possibilities of being permitted into her lodgings, if in such privacy she will once again guide his hand across her body. If, with the curtains drawn and her servants dismissed, she will remember what business was left undone the night before. It is, however, this thought that continues in his mind as he completes his morning circuit of the coffee houses, an action he has methodically repeated for 20 years, checking off one by one the news sheets he has read and the men he has whispered with until his routine is complete.
A tiny alley behind Gray's Inn Fields leads him to the counting house, wherein the mercantile business of Mr. Hancock and his partner Mr. Greaves is gravely attended to by six clerks and their crook-backed overseer, Scrimshaw. The counting house is a long red brick building, about 100 years old, which might once have been imposing, but the city has crept up on it from all sides, and now it sits 3 stories tall in its cramped court, like a rhinoceros in a rabbit hutch. While the dwellings around it are better built than those ramshackle edifices that grow up nearly overnight in the rookeries of St. Martin's, and which are liable to topple over in a shower of brick dust if any inhabitant turns over too heavy in their bed, they are hardly to be admired, being unornamented, thin-walled places with mean, lightless windows. They are home, however, to decent, unassuming people, 2 sisters in crocheted mittens, erstwhile mistresses of a failed dame school, and a law stationer who has somehow contrived to fit his shop, wife, dog, and 7 children behind his narrow front door. 3 of these children are in the yard as Mr. Hancock approaches the offices. 2 boys and a little girl, who stand around a set of arcane chalk marks on the flagstones, and take turns to throw down small twigs and pebbles with some energy.
"Good day,"
he says, and they tumble to bow to him.
Good day to you,"
they chirrup, nice children in clean, mended clothes, and he thinks, without meaning to,
"Had I children of my own, I would bring them here."
He feels an airy rush about his coattails, as if some little beings, buoyant with their play, were running to keep up with him. It is not merely a Henry who walks beside him today, but a whole gaggle of putative children, those who, through his own inaction, were never born. He mounts the steps of his building alone and lets himself in. The counting house is habitually quiet and dry, never more so than with the departure of Mr. Greaves and the removal of his wife to the country. The footsteps of the Greaves' children are no longer audible from the lodgings above. The work-day is not punctuated with domesticity, deliveries of cheese and milk and music teachers, the hall empty of visitors and of kitchen aromas. The counting house now smells only of whitewash, parchment and sand, its only sounds the rustle of papers, the scratch of nibs, and the persistent sniffing of Oliver, the youngest clerk. On the left of the entrance hall is a dining room, installed for the purpose of entertaining clients. Its polished tabletop and empty candlesticks are peaceful in their abandonment. On the right is the counting house where Scrimshaw the Beak hunches at his pedestal, swathed in the black gown he had made up during the reign of a previous George, and the clerks balance on stools before him. 2 are middle-aged, in the company through its permutations, for the Hancocks and the Greaveses, like all effective merchants, must be pliable in their ventures and their choice of business partners since boyhood. The others are newer additions, steady young men with good prospects, among them always a Hancock nephew or 2. He prefers not to take on any man with too evident an ambition, they being wont to make extra work, but he enjoys the satisfaction of watching faltering boys become confident men, training up a promising young clerk into a fine businessman on his own account. The men all rise when he enters.
"Good morning, sir."
"Good morning."
They look at him expectantly. Although the arrival of the mermaid has little practical connection to the office, beyond the paperwork pertaining to the loss of the Calliope and its promised cargo, they have taken a keen interest in its fate. Now they regard him in the polite but intense manner of well-trained dogs watching their master eat a plate of mutton chops.
"What news?"
croaks Scrimshaw, fossicking drops of candle wax from his wig.
"Regarding?"
"Last night," says Oliver.
"You went to King's Place, did you not?" says Jonathan, the nephew.
"I did."
"And?" No other man in this room has ever seen within a King's Place nunnery, nor are likely to, unless they are to ascend quite phenomenally in their lives. This is, however, the age of unlikely ascents.
What was it like? How was it done? What of the women?
He considers.
'Twas well done. The mermaid was greatly admired. They had displayed it in a manner theatrical and yet tasteful.
The men nod in satisfaction.
But what of the women?
The coals on the brazier shift and rattle. He thinks of Angelica, her back against the closed door, looking up at him. Nausea surges through him. He feels feverish, prickly.
I found it a most immoral place.
Foul-mouthed, were they? Drunkards? I cannot tolerate a woman who drinks,
nods the clerk his own age.
That's the real evil, the lack of delicacy.
Nothing of the sort, he says. They're good girls.
They always are, or start off that way,
says his clerk, Brown, who took his wife the same year Mr. Hancock married Mary, and who has 12 lusty children with her.
I never met a doxy as started out wicked, but I've come upon a fair few who have become so. Stealing and such.
The other men murmur in agreement.
What it is, says Scrimshaw, is the boards. They are the truly corrupt. Spend their whole lives in the trade, and now they will not save their sisters, but draw them into greater sin.
Aye, 'tis the boards who begin it all,
agrees Brown.
Who makes the whores but they? A jade, I'll forgive. She has her own reasons. But a madam?
He sucks his teeth.
Never. She's out for her own profit. Profits by us, profits by them. Where's her punishment?
It was the luxury,
Mr. Hancock says.
I did not like it.
He feels the eyes of his employees upon him, and adds grandly,
there was something of the fall of Rome about it. Such an excess of wine and naked women.
The rich,
grunts Mr. Scrimshaw.
The well-connected. Politicians. Idleness and excess curdles their brains. They live in a world of fantasy.
Yes, he nods. Yes, that is it entirely.
No place for a man of sense,
says young Oliver wistfully.
We are all best kept ignorant of it.
Yes,
Mr. Hancock says.
That is what I thought. I shall not call there again.
Is my fire made up?
And burning merrily,
says Oliver, who sees to all the office comforts. Then I shall get to work. Good day, gentlemen, he says. As he passes into the adjoining partner's office and closes the door behind him, he hears the clerks burst into excited whispering, to dissect all he has said and cast their own opinions upon it. Mr. Hancock regrets that Greaves himself is in Boston, for the silence sits heavy with him today. He sits down at the desk, beneath the portrait of his father and the portrait of his wife Mary's father, and under the gaze of a feathery miniature of his brother Philip, who drowned in Deptford Creek while rollicking home one night. And he touches to his nose a handkerchief worked by dear Suki, and thinks,
this is a good, honest place to be. And however wealthy I do become, I shall be no other sort than this.
The morning's letters are on his desk, but he hesitates to read them. First he sharpens a new quill with unusual care. Little coils of white shear away from it until he is satisfied that its mark will be both bold and firm. Then he lays out a sheet of fine white paper and inks the following.
Dear Mrs. Chapel, it is with regret that I find I must withdraw my exhibit from your home. You and I navigate very different worlds, madam,
And after last night's proceedings, I can no longer suffer my name to be associated with yours. I waive my right to the full balance of my fee, and I will be pleased to have my creature returned to me by tomorrow morning, and no later. He looks over it a moment, then draws out another sheet to make a fair copy, minus the sentiment of regret, and with addition of the word demand. For class is a type of bubble, a membrane around one, and although one might grow within this membrane and strain against it, it is impossible to break free from it. And a man of nobility is always such in his soul, however he may fall, and a man of humble sort is always such in his soul, however he may climb. He signs his name with a hand so exuberant it sends a spray of ink across the page, sprinkles it with pounce to hasten the drying, blows upon it, shakes it clear, folds it, and seals it. Then he rises.
"Oliver," he says, stepping into the office, "convey this to Mother Chapel."
He retreats into his office before he can be prevailed upon to elaborate. He has set things right, that is all. He will be what he was before. He will not entertain baubles one moment longer. And he still cannot decide, as he sets about his books and slits the first of the day's letters, whether he is content with this or tormented by it. Chapter 18. And what a joy it is to bask abed with a man of one's own choosing, to have one's face cupped in his warm hands, to have him marvel at the dilation of one's pupils and linger over the rosy tenderness of one's lips, to have him chafe the warmth back into one's fingers and feet. And what a joy it is, in turn, to observe the creasing about his eyes when he smiles, and to kiss the little margin of skin, pale and tender as a girl's, between the pink edge of his lips and the first of his carefully shaved bristles, and to discover the scar on his chin which he received falling out of a tree when he was six, and the crook in his right little finger which he received falling out of a club when he was 19, to learn these secrets about him. They sleep at first at Mrs. Chapel's house, in one of the bedrooms designed for receiving. The bed is so large it is almost a room in itself, and sprung with a buoyant ingenuity to which Mrs. Chapel herself holds the patent. Angelica divests herself immediately of her wet chemise, slopping it onto the floorboards without a second thought. If the lieutenant glimpses her naked body before she burrows beneath the covers, it can only be for a moment. Her desire to be warm trumps all thoughts of seduction. It is not, after all, as if any seduction is necessary, for this occurred all at first sight, and now they are only eager to be closer together. The lieutenant strips as dawn breaks in King's Place, and Angelica watches out of one eye, already beginning to drowse. He is a lean and long-limbed person, with a furze of dark hair along his thighs, which curve like a taut bow. When he slips into the bed, she is already nearly asleep, and she nestles her spine up against his belly. They knot naked around one another, but nothing is done. They are delighted by the bliss of their bare skin, this is all, and his fingers tangle loosely in her thick hair, and she glides her fingers along the back of his thigh. He puts his face by hers, his nose grazing her ear and his lips just upon her neck, until each of their breaths slows. Thus they sleep, and thus they wake. There ought to be little else said on the matter, for lovers are all the same, and only of interest to themselves. But on this count it is remarkable. Angelica Neal has not felt this way before. Or if she has, she has forgot. She who has made it her living to be touched thus, looked at thus, and rarely found it onerous, has forgot, until now, the joy of it. She feels as if she were made of glue,
or magnets, or kindling ready to take the first spark that leapt on it, and is astounded by it, as if this were an entirely new discovery. Later she will whisper that she will never want any other man again. Such is the drug which, dewed on the eyelids, makes yesterday inconsequential, and tomorrow certain, and today golden. Angelica and George, for overnight they have dispensed with honorifics, sigh smugly together in the bed until mid-afternoon, hearing far away the clatter of the girls loaded into the carriage for their exercise, and the scamper of servants in the passages behind the wall as they set right what was made wrong during the night. They take of one another for the first time as a persistent little dog scratches and whines outside their door to be let in, and then doze before doing it again. Their only disturbance is by a maid who brings them chocolate and rolls, and retreats in haste.
"We should leave,"
whispers Angelica, touching her fingertips to his as they lie face to face.
"Do not make me part with you," says George.
"I have no intention of it," she says, "but I do not wish to be overlooked by Mother Chapel."
They are silent a moment.
"What are your engagements?"
she asks. Their palms press flat against one another.
"None I cannot break for the next 2 days."
She grows brighter.
"Nor I. Come back with me."
He draws her to him, his fingers finding their home in the small of her back, for truly every part of his body finds its correspondence in hers.
"Let us stay together as long as we can," he says. "I could not wish to be anywhere else."
"I have an apartment," she says. "We'll not be disturbed."
"A little longer here," he says. "A little longer."
By the time they are dressed, it is late in the afternoon, and the sun has gone from the courtyard. They emerge into the city as if they had been gone from it a long time, its customs unfamiliar and all but irrelevant to them in their republic of two. They take a carriage and press close against one another within, and kiss and whisper as they watch the strange new world pass by outside. Chapter 19. Not 2 hours after his message is sent to Mrs. Chapel's, Mr. Hancock is returned to the exchange, and upon hearing his name called, turns to see one of her beautiful footmen striding through the crowd towards him. His livery shines blue as the most virgin winter morning. His wig is white as angel's wings. His skin is brown and smooth.
"Mr. Hancock," he repeats. "Sir?"
The crowd parts as he advances. This man, whose name in fact is Simeon Stanley, is not the only black in the room, but he may be the very smartest. The most peculiar thing about him is his scent. He smells of starch. He also smells of lavender water, tallow soap, damp wool, for the mist has left its dropples on the sleek shoulders of his greatcoat, and a sparing dab of middling quality eau de cologne. But what he does not smell of, not one atom, is his own man's body. He is so miraculous clean, it is as if he fell direct out of the blue sky. Not even a whiff of armpit emanates from him, not a hint of onions on his breath, not a notion that he has traversed the streets in haste. His Adam blue breeches must be fresh on, for a man's trousers become swiftly seasoned with the chafed, perspiring intricacies of their owner. Simeon Stanley may look like a man of flesh and blood, but for all his scent betrays it, from his crisply folded stock to the toes of his stockings, he might be made complete of feather-packed calico.
"I am sent by Mrs. Chapel," he says.
"She's received my letter, then?"
"Aye, and is much troubled by its contents. She begs that you inform her what made you change your mind."
Mr. Hancock struggles what to say.
You know the nature of that house yourself, he says.
Certainly I do, and I am proud to represent it, says Simeon. Mrs. Chapel has the ear of men who, they are my betters.
Mr. Hancock cuts him off.
Mine and yours. I've heard it many times, only I find I have left off believing it. I am not less honourable than those men I saw in attitudes of the most appalling degradation.
Mr. Stanley clings to his original message.
Do you feel you were misled? My mistress would be much grieved to think so. If there is something we can do, what would set this situation right, Mr. Hancock? What will please you?
Nothing but to have my mermaid returned to me.
The black man turns his eyes up most earnest.
Mrs. Chapel is anxious that you are happy.
That is easily settled, rejoins Mr. Hancock. Now leave me be, for I'm a busy man.
Simeon clears his throat. He is not particularly heavy set, but he is tall and now straightens his back so that his shoulders broaden. With perfect mildness, he forms a fist, whose knuckles are notably scuffed and scarred for one so otherwise refined, and touches it into the pale palm of his other hand. There is the pat of skin upon skin.
My mistress begs you recall the agreement you made with her, he says quietly. The contract she signed to hire your mermaid for 1 week, and the sum of 300 guineas she agreed to pay you in good faith. Do not think to intimidate me,
Mr. Hancock says, his eyes upon Simeon's clasped fist.
I am a man of business, and I do not deal with bullies.
This rankles.
You call me a bully, sir? What else were I to call you? You're employed by a madam to menace her clients. If you know of a better word, please, I should like to know it. I am a professional,
Simeon says sulkily.
A servant as good as any to be found in London's finest houses. Right you are. So, let us have no more of this thuggery. I am not in the habit of breaking my agreements, but needs must, do you not find? Sometimes, for the sake of one's good standing, 'tis better to break a contract than to honour it. She will pay you more, says Simeon promptly, for Mrs. Chapel has briefed him thoroughly on what might tempt the merchant back into tractability. Another £50. What say you? Guineas, she and I agreed. 50 guineas, then. But that's a detail. I still refuse. 100.
Mr. Hancock turns away. The footman watches him attentively for his next parry, but none comes. He puts his head on one side. A smile of gentle bafflement splits his face.
Surely, sir, he says, that's acceptable to you? I want my mermaid back, says Mr. Hancock, and turns to walk away, pushing out onto the street.
The footman follows with some effort, dodging amongst the convocation of businessmen and recalling to himself the next part of his script.
If 'tis influence you want, he pants, connections, why she can help you.
This gives Mr. Hancock a moment's pause. He looks at Simeon with renewed interest.
Say, he clears his throat, you move about the town a great deal, one fine house to another, do you not?
I do.
Simeon wonders at this change of tack, but determines to humour the gentleman.
Then what would you say will be the next most fashionable neighbourhood? If a man were to build houses, if he had money perhaps but had never speculated in London before, where ought he to build?
Simeon conceals a smile at this hobnail bumpkin with his threadbare wig, and endeavours to respond kindly.
Perhaps Snow Hill, sir, or out on the Mile End Road. A great many sea captains and merchants in those parts are wanting great houses.
Mr. Hancock shakes his head crossly.
No, no, no. I wish to build houses for fine people. No sits. No trade. Leisure.
Forgive me. A fashionable neighbourhood in town? I would say Marylebone, northwest of here. Fine, clean air. Halfway into the country already.
That is where you would build?
I didn't think of such a thing.
Simeon puffs up his chest.
But I shall have a tavern there some day, God willing. A fine, pretty situation it is.
Marylebone, repeats Mr. Hancock. Much obliged to you. Much obliged. Marylebone.
Then he claps his hat back onto his head.
As to the trouble with the mermaid, I regret you're wasting your time. I'll be wanting it back. Relay to your mistress. Mrs. Neal,
blurts Simeon. And this does stop Mr. Hancock in his tracks.
What of her?
He touches his unthinking fingers to his lower lip. This is Simeon's last card, and he is sorely aware of it. Angelica's tools of persuasion are very different from his own, and may in this case achieve better results. Either way, he will be glad to palm this trouble off.
She desires to see you, he says.
Mr. Hancock shuffles his feet.
She...
He shakes his head.
No, no, I do not think so.
Aye, yes, says Simeon, very eagerly. Will you not visit her this evening?
I cannot.
Sir, do you know how often Mrs. Neal requests the company of a gentleman? Almost never. They present themselves to her. But she waits upon you. You should go to her.
Mr. Hancock sighs.
This is all part of your mistress's persuasions.
Simeon shrugs. It is a fair hand. No need to overplay it.
She waits upon you. Go or do not. Here is where she may be found.
He takes from inside his jacket a card upon which is already written, in Mrs. Chapel's own hand, although Mr. Hancock does not know it, the address of Angelica's rooms.
Take it.
He holds it out. Mr. Hancock eyes it.
I have work to attend to.
Take it. Take it. What harm can it do? And then I shall leave you be.
Truly, what choice does Mr. Hancock have? With shaking hand and faltering heart, he reaches out and accepts Angelica Neal's summons. Chapter 20 Simeon, once he has watched Mr. Hancock vanish amongst the crowd of his own sort, sets off apace. He is a figure of some interest, he knows, for his livery is the colour of heaven, and he is half a head taller than most about him. But this, he observes, is due in part to their own slouching.
If they would take some pride in themselves, he thinks, they would not look so much at me.
As it is, some jeer.
Young Prince! Young Prince! Calls an apprentice. Mr. Snowball, pick up your feet!
And yes, he must tread most scrupulously across the filth, wincing with disgust as he strides over the channel of effluvium that runs down the centre of the roadway. He passes the seafarer's hall, within whiff of the water, with alleys here and there that afford him a glimpse of great white sails. He passes the workshops of the cordwainers, the print shops at St. Paul's, the fruit wagons of St. Clement's, and everywhere he goes, with his quick, light step and his head held high, every pair of eyes in the great population of the streets sees that here is an important man, knows by his finery that he must be the most favoured messenger of an influential house. Simeon, swatting soot from one shoulder, strides onward. He skirts the edge of St. Giles, a low sort of a place, where he might come by an accident at the wrong end of a blade. He hurries past an old Lascar, begging on the street, who raises the leg of his pantaloon to show a great ulcer embedded like a yolk in the twiggy bone beneath. The man is naked beneath his jacket, and his dark skin slack and meagre over his ribcage. His eyeballs have a discoloured look to them, as if they had been dipped in tea, and the corners of his lips are pale and scurfy. Simeon himself was never a sailor, but he perceives that this man will not join another crew.
"Brother!"
calls the Lascar, holding out his bowl.
"Brother! Help me!"
But Simeon wrinkles his nose. He thinks how he might describe this later to his friends, the footmen and grocers and cabinet-makers of his own race, with their elegant wool jackets and embroidered waistcoats and powdered hair. He puzzles over what words he might use, but he knows he will say nothing. For how can it be said? And what good will speaking it do? He strides away from the Lascar without looking back, but the memory of him will crouch in Simeon's belly for quite some time longer. Do not imagine that he betrays any perturbation in his demeanour. He arrives at Dean Street cool as a china dog, and there is Mrs. Frost's peevish face half lost in darkness behind the first-floor window. When she sees him, she raises it open and leans out at once.
"I've a message for Mrs. Neal," he says. "Well, then, you've wasted your journey, for she ain't returned from King's Place."
"I am sent from there."
He gestures to his blue jacket, in case it has escaped her notice, but Mrs. Frost's expression does not alter.
"Come down. I shall not shout it."
She vanishes smartly, and in seconds emerges from the front door, like an automaton in a novelty clock.
"What is it, then?"
she snaps. She does not waste her courtesy on servants.
"Mrs. Neal met with a gentleman last night," says Simeon, "and my mistress is anxious to persuade him of something. I bade him call here on her behalf, that Mrs. Neal may flatter him, as I may not."
"So I must expect a gentleman?"
"Yes, and obstruct him by no means. He must be free to unburden himself. He is troubled by some business with my mistress."
Mrs. Frost harumphs.
"Mrs. Neal has her own interests to attend to. How many more favours does Mrs. Chapel expect?"
"'Tis all the one favour."
"Well, it makes a great many demands on her time."
He spreads his hands.
"Take it up with my mistress, or with yours."
"My mistress? Impudence! She is not my employer. She is my friend."
Simeon looks her up and down.
"Much good it does you,"
he says, and bestows upon her the most delightful of smiles. Mr. Hancock is a man of particular impressionability, this is true, but it takes him less than 4 hours to set his mind on visiting Angelica Neal that very evening. He knows not what he will say or do.
"But she awaits me there," he thinks. "I cannot do her the double dishonour of snubbing her invitation. Certainly I will not give way on the question of the mermaid. But is it not a fine pretext to see her again?"
He has come to the conclusion that, however disgraceful her circle, he must display courtesy beyond it.
"For I, although not so socially elevated, am the better man. I would treat no girl that way. I would never disport myself so amongst my peers. I am cognizant, as those gentlemen are not, that all pleasures have their cost."
He makes his way there as swiftly as he may, but all along the Strand the girls are coming out for their evening's work. They perch on doorsteps and window ledges, or stand in small groups, passing a bottle between them, and flirting their brightly coloured skirts up to show their frilled petticoats beneath. There are some as stand on the edge of the pavement, if there be pavement at all, nervous and watchful, their eyes flicking from one man to the next, as an animal's eyes will dart in search of safety. Every man who passes, they try to meet his gaze. Every gaze they meet, their faces twitch into a smile. Mr. Hancock strides with his head down, but they approach him still, laying their hands on his sleeve as he passes.
"Walk me home?" one asks.
"I've something you want, sir," confides another. The ones out in daylight have little besides the obvious to be ashamed of. Their faces youthful and only lightly painted. The state of their dresses respectable at first glance, if not at second. The ghastly ones, the toothless, the rotten, the old and the filthy, are not to be seen. They conceal themselves in their crooked alleys, or wait until the small hours when they might conjure their lost charms with drink and darkness. He is turning up Half Moon Street when a young one steps into his path. She is neither exceptional pretty nor exceptional plain, just a little brown-haired country girl of perhaps 16 years, with a faded kerchief knotted about her neck, and her stays all shiny with wear. She starts to trot alongside him, and although he picks up his pace, she picks up hers too, her borrowed hoops rocking this way and that.
"Sir," she says, "you'll not stop a while?"
"Thank you, no,"
he pants, for the exertion to escape her is more than he is accustomed to. Still, she does not fall back.
"I know an alehouse near here," she says, "a decent place to pass an hour."
She twists her fingers wretchedly. She wears no gloves, and her hands are white and bony, with crescents of black under the nails.
"It has an upstairs room."
"Be off with you," he says. "This won't do."
But the little jade pursues him still.
"Sixpence and a jug of wine, that's all I ask," she says. "I'll see you right."
He stops, and she fairly trips over her feet. No wonder, for her shoes are too large and slither up and down her heel as she walks. He looks into her face. She is all unpainted, a spray of freckles over her nose.
"Who runs you?" he asks.
"Nobody,"
she says.
"Is that the truth? No bully? No board?"
"No, sir. I do trade alone."
He sighs and rummages a shilling from his pocket. He holds it out for her to see.
"Enough to find somewhere warm and a bite to eat. Perhaps a candle. This is for nobody's spending but your own. Do you mark me?"
She does not move. He has never seen anybody stare at a coin so intently.
"Go,"
he says, holding it out to her. She looks at him stupidly.
"I want nothing of you, only that I shall not see you on the street again tonight."
She holds out her palm, and when he drops the coin into it, her fingers snap closed like a trap. She brings her fist close to her chest.
"Thank you, sir."
She drops a curtsy and hastens away, he hopes to a pie shop, but perhaps back to the spot on the pavement where she began.
"As if she will spend it on anything but gin,"
he thinks to himself as she vanishes into the crowd. "As if a mere 12 pence could help the child.
Where is her family, and why does she not return to them? Confound it, a respectable man ought to be able to walk down the street without being accosted."
And onward into Soho he goes, irritated by his own softening. All the way to Dean Street he finds women's hands on his cuff, their entreaties in his ears. It seems there is not one woman abroad who might not open her legs, given the opportunity. The milliner's girls, with their goods parcelled up, whisper,
"I have time to tarry,"
and the dressers who have been turned away superfluous from the theatres call.
An unusual evening that I'm at my liberty. This chance will not come to you again.
And yet all about them is industry. He sees printers' apprentices with their inky fingers, blacksmiths and piemen and builders and lawyers. Doctors bustle the streets in their cauliflower wigs. Apothecaries scoop from great majolica jars. Furniture salesmen sit happy behind mullioned windows. But amongst all this brave order, there are those who have fallen loose from it as screws from a fine machine. In this city of 1,000 trades, there is only one that the women return to as if they were called to it. He comes to Dean Street. At Angelica's address, the first floor window is open, and a narrow, tidy-looking woman sits within, leaning an elbow on its sill.
"Good day to you," he calls up, raising his hat.
She does not look up immediately, preferring to finish whatever she is scribbling in her pocket-book. And then her irritable blink is something like Hester's when she has lost her spectacles, although she is much younger.
"May I help you?" she asks.
"I am after Mrs. Neil,"
he bellows. He is painful conscious of the other people in the street, the good washerwomen and tradesmen, the mantua makers, seamstresses, who are quick to gather at their window below Mrs. Neil's as if it were a theatre box. It is unfortunate that he is unconscious of Angelica's giggling return to her rooms not 2 hours earlier, wrapped in a wool blanket, and with her soaked underclothes and Mr. Rockingham in tow.
"This is the gentleman you met at Mrs. Chapel's, I suppose," had said Mrs. Frost once they were alone in the dressing-room.
"I don't see what it is to you,"
Angelica retorted.
"Here, my gown must be left at Mrs. Chapel's. What locks! You might send and see if it has been found."
"But the gentleman?"
"Yes, for pity's sake, Eliza, yes, he is from Mrs. Chapel's. I met him there yesterday, and I shall keep him with me tonight. Does that satisfy you? Well, leave us be."
Mrs. Frost now raises the sash and leans out further, eyeing Mr. Hancock carefully.
"And what are you wanting with her?"
She's always judicious in her assessment of visitors. This man, his thumbs notched into his pockets, looks like neither a gentleman nor a bailiff. But if she had to choose, she would lean to the latter.
"Why, I wish to see her. To talk, if I may. I met her last night."
"That hardly sets you apart. Your name?"
"Hancock."
He removes his hat and turns it around in his hands. "The mermaid man," he wants to add, but he bites it back as folly.
"Never heard of you."
She turns her head from the window. Within, although he cannot know, Angelica Neil is locked in her bedroom, cocooned in love.
"Well, she's not at liberty."
"I met her last night," he repeats. "I did not treat her as I ought. And I..."
"Not today," said Mrs. Frost. "She will see nobody."
The girls and the mantua makers below seem to Mr. Hancock remarkable short of occupation. They now push their own window as far open as it will go and prop their elbows on the frame to watch the back and forth on the street. Mr. Hancock, standing not 2 yards distant from their beady interest, shuffles his feet and endeavours to hasten his inquiries.
"But if you would perhaps tell her that I..."
"If I were to run every entreaty left with me for Mrs. Neil, I would wear my feet to stumps,"
snaps Mrs. Frost.
"This is not your day, sir. Come by again, if you must."
Then she pulls the window down and leaves him confounded on the pavement.
"What now, sir?"
asks one amongst his audience of seamstresses.
"Surely you'll not go home so insulted."
He straightens his jacket and says nothing, but they lean out further to him.
"You'll not be refused entrance here,"
one of the girls says.
"I beg you."
"We'll give you a good price. Come in, come in."
They jostle and whisper and emit a great spray of laughter, and he retreats quite burning with shame and perplexion. Volume 2 Chapter 1
"You have lost me, my mermaid!"
Mrs. Chapel's chins quiver with rage as she slops across the marble floor in her wrap and her rabbit fur slippers. She has foregone her wig for a starched and frilled cap, and wears spectacles very low down her nose. Denuded of her rouge and jewels, she appears less imposing, but far sterner. There is no weakness in her bare, slackening skin or the furrow of her brow. In fact, she never looked more of a matriarch.
"Is this why you sent for me?"
says Angelica, much put out. She had wavered, indeed, over responding to the abbess's summons, Mr. Rockingham being so very much on her mind.
"But I promised to oblige her, and there is always something in it for me,"
she had told herself. 2 days in the other world of his arms has made her ebullient and proud of herself. She is in the mood to be amongst friends and revel in her own magnetism. If she had recalled that Mrs. Chapel did no entertaining at all before 2, that the first part of her day has ever been devoted to the driest of business, she might have prepared herself not to be greeted with perfect civility at King's Place, the site of such recent and dazzling triumphs. The house is rather unusually silent, as if the girls and dogs running about upstairs were not so lively today, and the footman who steps forward for her cloak lacks a certain sprightliness.
"And what are you talking about?"
she asks.
"I have lost your mermaid?
If I have, I'm afraid I know nothing of it." Above there is a rustling on the stairs, where Eleanor begins to descend.
"Good morning,"
Angelica calls.
"Or has it yet struck noon?"
But Mrs. Chapel shoots the girl a look of dark warning, so that she turns tail and vanishes the way she came.
"That don't bode well,"
quips Angelica, who has experience of that expression. Guilt now tweaks at her, and she thinks for the first time of Mr. Hancock, the mermaid man, who was in her care and departed it, she now recalls, far from easy. Still, there is no reason to admit fault until it is proven beyond the possibility of denial.
"My room, if you please," says Mrs. Chapel stiffly.
"You're dreadful cross,"
observes Angelica lightly, but she follows the abbess into the green-papered parlour without protestation. The curtains are open and the fire is burning, but there is no tea laid out there, no Madeira or biscuits, and Mrs. Chapel calls for none.
"You have lost me, a mermaid," she repeats.
"Will you permit me to sit down?"
The abbess harumphs, and Angelica takes her place on the sofa, slumping over its arm. In this attitude, she marks suddenly the ache in her commodity and the rawness where her thighs touch. Too much fun. She cannot keep the smile from her face. Perhaps it is to the good that Rockingham has returned to his studies for a few days, although she is already drafting her first letter to him in her head. Her body could not take much more of his ardour.
"Sit up straight," snaps Mrs. Chapel, "and you can wipe off that saucy look too. I never was so vexed with you, never so vexed with any of my girls."
"I cannot bear the suspense. Madam, what have I done?"
Mrs. Chapel extends a furious finger.
"You have..."
"No, no, do not repeat it. I misspoke. You made yourself clear. I have lost you a mermaid." "How did I effect such a thing?"
"Mr. Hancock has removed it from exhibition in this house."
She recalls his foolish, panicked stagger away from her, and how he blundered through the crowd.
"You cannot blame that all on me,"
she scowls.
"Any number of things may have displeased him. You orchestrated the entire night. After all, my role in it was very minor indeed."
Mrs. Chapel narrows her eyes.
"No more of your babble," she says. "Your pertness today is not at all to my taste. You did not take care of